Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown, out on the edge of the prairie. Such a beautiful, beautiful, heartbreaking, terribly beautiful fall. You go out and walk along the streets of that little town under the golden and the red and the orange trees. And if your heart has never been broken before, it'll be broken now. And you think it's fall. Winter will soon be here. Eventually we'll all die. How beautiful life is. The Tollerudes, Daryl and Marilyn, delivered their son Eric to St. Cloud State for his sophomore year a few weeks ago. He wanted to live on his own in a house with some other guys. He thought it would be valuable educational experience to be in a cooperative learning situation and take care of housekeeping and cooking and buying groceries and so on, all five of them. And they agreed, though they did think the rent was rather high for a house as chunky as that. And then just on Sunday, they realized that he had forgotten his warm clothing at home. So they were going to go in for Marilyn's parents, the Englers' 60th wedding anniversary at the Good Shepherd home anyway, so they thought they would drop off the warm clothes at Eric's. They came as a little bit after noon. They went around to the back. Daryl tried the door. It wasn't locked. It opened. Marilyn said, "Don't you think we should knock? Maybe we should have called." They walked into the kitchen, and there was an aroma reminiscent of livestock and smoke and beer. The kitchen sink, both sides, was filled with beer bottles, and there were beer bottles in tight formation, shoulder to shoulder, all along the counter, along two walls. There was a stack of pizza boxes in the corner that was 4 feet high after just 2 weeks at school. And the floor was littered with dust balls and with dirty laundry, boys' shirts and pants and underpants with skid marks in the seat. They were going to tiptoe out, and then they overheard a boy in the next room say, "Have you ever had the experience you wake up in the morning and you turn over and there she is and you can't remember her name, if it's Kirsten or Kristen or what it is?" And another voice said, "Yeah, that's a bummer." And the second voice was the voice of their son. They stopped to think about this, and suddenly a boy shrieked, "Flush!" And a naked boy, dripping wet, came dashing into the kitchen from the shower and then saw them and stood and covered himself with his hands and said, "Good morning." Actually, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They said, "Just brought some clothes by, didn't mean to interrupt anything," and they left. They got in their car and they drove to the Good Shepherd home where the Englers sat like stuffed dummies in their wheelchairs. They brought out the cake with the little groom and the bride on top of it, and Marilyn's mother held the knife in her hand as Marilyn guided her hand. Her mother smiled up at her. She didn't know who these people were or what they were doing. They sliced the cake, and Marilyn leaned over. She said, "I'm Marilyn, your daughter, Marilyn." Her mother looked up and smiled and said, "Tell Grandpa that when he's done with the horses, we held supper for him." It was a quiet drive home after that. And then Marilyn said finally, she said, "I suppose it's a good idea to save up good memories when you're young so that when you go off to the rest home, you can look back and remember when you woke up in bed next to somebody whose name you didn't know. And you called out for pizza for breakfast. When Daryl first met her parents, was brought home for the formal presentation at court for Sunday dinner. He was 21 years old. He had hair down to his shoulders. He didn't have a suit. He wore a serape and a flowered shirt and boots. He was just out of the army. He let his hair grow long. He went out to the Anglers for Sunday dinner. Daryl went through a sort of neo-romantic phase before he got into hog farming. He read Steppenwolf and was looking to discover his true self outside the restrictions of society. And so, of course, he felt, and Marilyn agreed with him, that it would be dishonest to go out to meet her parents in a suit, but they drove around for a while on Sunday discussing this, and finally she convinced him that her parents would never be able to see past the serape, to see the real Daryl, so that going out to visit them in a serape would sort of be like speaking French to people who only understood Norwegian. He said, "All right, but where can I get a suit?" She thought of her uncle Edgar, an old bachelor living alone up near Gull Lake, living alone in a house full of cats. She thought, "I'll bet Uncle Edgar would have a suit that would fit you. He's kind of a free spirit." So they drove up to Uncle Edgar's house, and he was there. He came out to meet them. He was so joyed to see them. "You're in love," he said. "You're going to be married. Wonderful. You have to come in. We have to celebrate this." He put a Jussi Björling record on the hi-fi, and he pulled out jars of herring and cheese and pâté and plates of this and bowls of that, and he set out a spread. They said, "We can't stay. We're on our way to dinner." "No," he said, "you've got to. We can't let an occasion pass without celebration." He laid out this spread, and he brought out a bottle of aquavit, and he poured three glasses of it all around, and he toasted them, and he toasted them again. And 2 hours later, when they left, there was stuffed full of cheese and meat and bread, and there were three sheets to the wind. They hauled into the Anglers for Sunday dinner. They were an hour and a half late. The family had already cleared the table. There were very thin smiles to welcome, a very chilled courtesy in the air. They went and reheated everything. There they were, drunk, full of food, feeling ill, and Daryl was wearing an old blue serge suit that looked as if he'd slept in it all night. He sat down next to Mr. Engler at the table. Mr. Engler said, "So, Marilyn says you're thinking of going into partnership with your dad, raising hogs." Actually, Daryl had been thinking about going off on a quest in partnership with Marilyn. But he said, yes, he was thinking about it. And the subject of hogs struck a chord with Mr. Engler. Hogs were close to his heart. He had a lot of opinions about raising animals in isolation and about breeding and about Yorkshires, which he felt were the best hogs. Well, yes, Daryl had to agree with that. Yorkshires, he liked Yorkshires himself, as the reheated meatloaf was passed by them and the reheated potatoes. And the serving dishes seemed to be on a sort of carousel, and the room itself seemed to spin. And Marilyn excused herself and went up to the bathroom and emptied her stomach and came back down. Her mother looked at her. She said, "Are you getting enough to eat? You look so pale." Daryl was in the midst of a big conversation with her father on the subject of Yorkshire swine and how important it was to get the best commercial semen to build up your herd and the durability of this breed and the wonderful ratio of conversion of feed to meat, and especially the loins. That's where the money, the profit is in hogs, is in loins, her father said. They were married 3 months later. He wore a suit. He did not wear a serape. She was not his first love, Marilyn. His first love was a girl named Ellen, who was at St. Olaf and whom he had met at a Grateful Dead concert in Minneapolis when her ride had left early without her. Darryl gave her a ride back to St. Olaf, and they spent the night walking around the beautiful campus and talking until the sun came up and she gave him 2 lilac sprigs, and he took them home with him and realized that he was in love with this woman from Chicago. He just earlier this summer found a whole box of letters that Ellen wrote to him in the space of about a year and a half that they were sweethearts many years ago. He found them in the attic. They were in an old tape box that was sealed with masking tape that was drying and brittle, falling apart. It was marked miscellaneous. He opened it, and there were stacks of letters written in her familiar hand on beautiful stationery. He sat and he read them, and he was overwhelmed with nostalgia, overwhelmed with longing for those days and nights long ago when he was a different person, when he was young, when he was immortal, when the whole world stretched out in front of him. He was in love with her. He visited her every chance he got. They walked around the campus. And then in between visits, she wrote to him. She wrote how much she missed him. She wrote about her courses. She wrote about history, about her term paper that she was writing about the French resistance and how during the Nazi occupation of France, French people who wished to go on leading a normal middle-class life had to make their arrangement to some degree with the Germans. They were all collaborationists to some small degree if you wanted to go on as you were, and how we would not sell out in this way, how we would be free, and how we would travel the world supporting ourselves in order to have experiences. And he realized that the we she wrote about meant him and her, the two of them. He sat and he read about half of the letters in that box, and they brought him to tears, remembering that sweet girl and those long ago golden, green and golden days. She quoted back to him the lines from Whitman and Thoreau that he had quoted to her. And it wasn't so much her that he felt nostalgic for as for the person he had been long ago. He remembered a poem that she had quoted to him about success. Success is counted sweetest. And he went down to the Lake Wobegon Library to ask about it. He asked Grace, the librarian, if she'd ever heard of that poem. She didn't even look up from her desk. She just recited it to him. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host that won the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated dying on whose forbidden ear the distant sounds of triumph ring so clear. "Does that mean what I think it means?" he said. "Yes," said Grace. "It means that beauty is appreciated most by those who don't have it. It's a Puritan thing." He had heard that she married somebody, an executive in one of the big corporations in Minneapolis, Pillsbury or General Mills, and that she was living there in the city. And he thought about looking her up. He threw away some of the letters, but he saved his favorites. And he put them in the garage up on a high shelf up with the fishing tackle. And every day through August and some of September, he would allow himself to read one letter from her. A letter in which she said, "I count the hours until Friday at 7 when I sit on the front steps of Gridley Hall and look up the road for your green car." He could remember why they had broken up. It was because she came from a wealthy family in Chicago and because she was nobody who his family could ever accept. She was a young woman for whom the words cooking, cleaning, washing may as well have been cities in China. She was nobody who could come and live on the farm. But how wonderful that she longed for him in this letter. It had been a long time since anyone missed him so much that they sat and waited for him to come up the road. He thought about calling her up, going out to have lunch. He imagined having lunch with her, how nice it might be. He imagined she might come to lunch and tell him that she was divorced and sort of at a crossroads in her life. He found her phone number on the internet. It took about 15 seconds to find it. He wrote it down on a piece of paper and folded it twice and put it in his pocket. He threw away some more of the letters but saved a few. He woke up late one night. It was after midnight. He woke up thinking about her, lying in bed with Marilyn. And then his beeper went off on his belt, hanging over the seat, the beeper from the volunteer fire department. And he leaped out of bed and he pulled on his pants and his shoes and his sweater and he ran out and he got in his car and he drove into town. The truck was not in the fire barn, but he could see the red light. It was up on the hill. It was up in front of the Catholic church. He drove up there and parked behind it. There was a crowd already starting to assemble. He got out of his car and he could hear laughing and shouting. It sounded like a party. And then he realized it was Canadian geese, a whole flock of them. They were beside the church, and Father Wilmer was there, and Sister Arvon was there, and people were arriving, headlights coming up the street. People hate to miss a crisis in Lake Wobegon. There's so few of them, you know. You want to enjoy them. Sister Arvon said that two geese had gotten into the church, perhaps through an open window in the bell tower, and that when she had tried to get them out, they had attacked her. The door to the church was open. Darrell walked in. It was all dim except for one light up above the altar, and he could see the geese were up behind the altar. They were muttering to themselves. More people were coming. People were standing by the front door. They were saying, "We ought to go get nets. We ought to go get some cracked corn. We ought to ring the bells, drive them out." Daryl said, people go home. Go home. We'll never get these geese out of here with all this crowd standing around the front door. Go home, please. And one by one, slowly, they left and they went home. And the fire truck was driven back to the fire barn. And at last, Daryl was alone with the geese on the yard, who hunkered down as if they might be willing to spend the night. He sat down by the street, his back against a tree, and he waited for the geese to come out of the church. He could remember his father standing on the porch late Saturday night, waiting for Daryl's brother Tom to come home when Tom was running with a rough crowd. The lonely duties of a father, to wait and to hope and to pray. He waited for the geese to come out. He promised himself that he would put the letters away and not read them again for 10 years at least. He dozed off, and he had just the briefest little wisp of a dream. He was walking with a woman up a hill, and her arm was around him and his around hers. His hand rested on her right hip. His finger was hooked into the belt loop of her trousers, and he could feel that sensuous motion of her hips as she walked. And then he heard a great rush of wings as all of the geese dashed across the grass and took off, shouting and laughing to each other, heading south until he could hear them no more. He walked into the church. He looked all around. He looked back around behind the statue of the Blessed Virgin, her head bowed, holding her hands out. There were no geese in the church. He paused for a moment in the dark, and then he closed the doors, and he turned, and he went home. Love belongs to people whose hearts have been broken. Nobody appreciates a warm autumn night so much as a Minnesotan. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children above average.